was just wondering if you have the number. So let's see. Well, if I can give you all that, we'll give you an introduction. I think I'll start with the usual kind of themes in teaching. You first are supposed to say what, and then you're supposed to say how, and then you're supposed to say why. So what I did is that 21 months ago, I moved to Shravasti Abbey, and I did it in pieces because that was the way I could do it. I had been a student of Venerable's for about 13 years at the time, and going to 2 retreats a year pretty much with her, spring and winter, usually at Cloud Mountain. And she's the one that introduced me to Geshe-la, got me connected with Geshe-la, so therefore connected with Aum-Ji, and which is wonderful. And so I first went to the Abbey for a 3-month retreat, the one that she showed, Lama Zopa there, the Vajrasattva initiation, and Kat was there for that. I don't know if anybody else was. On the actual 3-month retreat, Susan was our cook and lived at the Abbey for 3 months. So it's just like some kind of reunion here. I finally kept moving closer and closer, and as I've said to many of my friends in Portland and my husband, who I left, who's still my good friend, I said, I cannot not do this. It just came down to that. I cannot not do this. It was like, I cannot come to the day of my death and not take this step. And that was just so clear to me. And so he and many others have been very saddened and very supportive, both at the same time. So so I live at the Abbey, and I think the best way to, and I'm going to stay there for the foreseeable future, which is 1 minute from now. You know, as His Holiness says, next breath or next life, who knows? You know, which is so accurate. I mean, we've all seen and experienced so many friends dying that it could be next breath or next life. So for the foreseeable future, I'll be there. And I'm quite happy. The practice is, you know, there's a saying, Kat asked me to talk a little bit about teacher to student relationship. And there's a saying, you know, your teacher is like a fire. And it's true in terms of the Dharma. And you want to get close enough that you can feel the heat, but not so close that you get toasted or burnt, you know, really burnt, because that can be too much for you. So I feel like I'm in there with a lot of heat, but just about right. And, of course, in a community of 10, there's 10 of us living there with 6 monastics and 4 lay people right now. Well, 3 lay people and 1 what's called Anagarika, which is a person who's taken more vows and is headed towards taking the first set of monastic vows. There's only 1 monk and there's 5 nuns. So we're very, very happy about all these developments. It's just going just right. So anyway, I don't want to talk too long. What I want to do is really make room for you to ask your real questions about what it's like or what you're interested in or what you're curious about. I thought I might just kind of outline this in the 3 principal aspects of the path, the first one being what's called renunciation, but I really like the translation of the determination to be free, which is really the essence of renunciation, is the determination to be free. Free of what? Free of the suffering mind. It's not free of the city, or free of a car, or free of cell phones, which we are free of all those, which is very helpful. And it's not free of, you know, your partner. What it's free of is free of the suffering mind. So that renunciation, it takes a while to kind of figure out for each of us, and it's going to be different for everybody. What does that take? You know, what form does that take? And for me, having gone to quite a number of retreats, I don't know, maybe 9-day retreats, a 1-month retreat, a 3-month retreat, and I had begun to work part-time in Portland and had the lovely support of my husband and was, as you all know, practicing many times with all of you here or at my retreat or wherever. it just became not enough for me to move towards closer and closer to that determination. It was like, this is wonderful, this is great, and what's next? That was what was pushing inside of me, in a good way pushing. And and of course, being in terms of the determination to be free around Westerners who have shaved their heads, donned the robes, taken 234 vows, or whatever it is the nuns take, and watched them work so hard to try and keep them, and so hard to keep them, because this is not a Western cultural anything. I guess we can look at Judeo-Christian religions and think about, you know, monastics in like the Catholic tradition or some others, but there's just something more about what these folks do. And now, of course, many of those Judeo-Christian monastic traditions have gone back to having long hair and wearing Western clothes and all that. So it's extremely inspiring. Of the five nuns, Nance, who is Venerable Semke, was Nance to me and went through all these retreats with me. So I also got to see the, and some of you have very close monastic friends, so you just get to see it in a different way, that kind of step by step by step towards that. And then the same with Barbara, who is Venerable Chinny, the same with Jan, who is Venerable Tarpa, Diane, who is now Venerable Jigme, and then Jumpel, Venerable Jumpel, actually came out of the prisons, the young monk, and has been at the Abbey for 2 years and met Venerable in prison. And I tell that because it's a very public, open story. Which is incredible karma. He literally, when he saw her come to talk to the prison the first time, the karmic seed just went pow, and he was freaking out, you know, like, who is this, and what's happening to me? And I, you know, this approach avoidance thing, like, I can't wait to talk to her, and I'm about to run out of the room, you know, which I think is the struggle with your own self-centered attitude, which kind of wants you to not move in that direction, and then your Buddha nature is pulling you there, kind of like a little river running. So his story is quite remarkable. So that's the renunciation part. I can talk more about it. As a lay person, the way I renounce is I have the five vows, you know, not to kill, not steal, not lie, no sexual behavior, and no intoxicant. I've increased my no unwise sexual behavior to celibacy this last year. So I live with those, but because I live in the monastery, I also by default take the other three of the eight Mahayana vows, which is no entertainment, no perfume and jewelry, because we just don't do these things, and eating one meal a day. I don't take that one because we work physically really hard, and sometimes and the monastics have leeway, especially if you do forest work, garden work, kitchen work, you're just pouring out energy, so one meal a day wouldn't work. The one meal a day was set up for monks who were studying, you know, and meditating pretty much all day, which is a bit more sedentary. And they were walking a lot, but not tearing down trees and cutting firewood and hauling rocks, which is some of the stuff we do. That's how the renunciation comes across for me. And then just the modeling of being around people who are, you know, for full-out renunciation, shaved heads, you know, two sets of robes, you know, and many of them not even the evening meal. You know, always working on the whole thing around food and food craving, you know, how we get caught in that. So that's kind of the renunciation piece. And then the second piece being on the three principal aspects of the path is developing bodhicitta, which is what has happened with me with that is such a big change. So first I'll say what I understand it to be, which is the desire and actions toward gaining enlightenment for the benefit of all sentient beings. That's what makes it bodhicitta, you know, as opposed to what an arhat does, which is self-liberation. You know, I want enlightenment. But what makes it into bodhicitta is I want it in order to benefit all sentient beings and bring them. My own enlightenment is not worth more
or is so interconnected I can't have that without everyone. So, of course, the interesting thing, and I'm just being very frank here about it because of who you all are, who I've known for a long time, but I probably say this to anybody at this point, is I had some idea that I had developed some bodhicitta. And what I have come to understand is it is so deep and so wide, it is so difficult to actually get out of the self-centered, self-cherishing hallucination for even a moment to actually do something purely for someone else. It's not because we're bad, it's just because we're so stuck in this mucky, graspy, gluey thing of what do I want and need? How is this for me? Yes, I'll help you out, but then I want you to notice I did that. You know, I mean, just all the pieces. So it's a very good development. It's not discouraging at all. It's just a wonderful development, but it just shows you this is going to take three countless eons. And we better just do it joyfully, step by step, with a lot of patience. And it's not like, you know, next month I'm going to be the Buddha, you know. On the other hand, who knows, you know, leave the room for miracles, as they say. But it's a lot of work to get a grip at crystal clear look at what is that self-centered hallucination, what is it, and how does it function, and how do I dismantle it with using the antidotes and purification and gathering merit, you know, with all the good works, you know. So that piece, the bodhicitta, and then of course the third part of the three principal aspects of the path is the view of reality, you know, pure wisdom, the actual accurate view of reality. What are we? Where are we? What are we made up of? What is the lack of inherent existence of this self? What is that really? What is the complete interconnectedness? What does dependent arising actually mean? What does something abiding in non-dual, you know, emptiness mean? What could that possibly mean? So that is just something we work away at, get lots of teachings on, get chances to read, get chances to talk about, and you saw the wonderful array of teachers that have come through. And Jeffrey Hopkins wasn't on there, but he's come through and taught a piece on, a bit on emptiness. This last second time he came through, he taught on compassion. So I guess the only other thing to say is I could just tell you what the schedule's like, and then I just like to throw it open and hear what you're interested in. So we get up around 4:30, quarter to 5 each morning. Generally, there's 10 of us there, but we have a lot of retreats in the summer, so there could be as many as 30 there. We had our first one-week retreat with 28, which is very nice, because now that we have Gautami Hall, thanks to many of you who have contributed, we can have that many people come sleep and all be residential. So it was lovely. And some of Venerable's longtime students from Seattle who hadn't come at all came, and that was very, very sweet for her and them. So we get up and we're in the hall by 5:30, and we meditate from 5:30 to 7:15. And each month we do a different sadhana, which I think has been a tradition here when sadhanas were going on. You know, you do green Tara for a month, and then Manjushri for a month, and then, you know, we just finished white Tara and we're on to Manjushri, and we did Vajrasattva. So that's wonderful, and we go year-round, kind of Blue Medicine Buddha, going through those and do a solid month of them. And then the 35 Buddhas every morning, the prostrations. And then we go to breakfast and have breakfast from 7:30 to 8. And then there's service. There's enough of us down that we actually have areas that we're responsible for, and I just finished 18 months in the kitchen. And I'm so glad to be out of the kitchen. Oh my gosh, it's so true about Dharma kitchens. They are wonderful practice in every way. But what happened for me is it just got too physical. You know, I mean, with the growing numbers coming in for retreats, and then we had a big celebration last October was 60, and a bigger celebration, this one, was 70. And it's just a huge amount of physical work, no matter how many are helping. And I turned 62, and it was like, this is right on the edge of too much. So I've been out in the garden more, and I've been in the library more, and I'm going to be doing more office work. So we'll see. But it's just lovely to be able to serve. I mean, it's just, it's so delicious, is how I can say it, whether in the kitchen or in the garden, or you're grumpy or you're happy. It's just delicious to be able to serve. There's no ambivalence for me about, I wonder if I'm doing anything meritorious today. You know what I mean? It's like sometimes here you're on the freeway and you can dedicate it and you can do all that, and it definitely can be a Dharma practice. Anything, riding a bus, you know, making your own meal, all of that can be and is, but there's just this kind of clarity when you're with a whole group. I was thinking about how to try to explain this today, but you're in a whole group, and this is all they're studying. They're not wanting to go off and do a watercolor class, which is wonderful, I've done those, or a fiction writing class, or go down to the university and learn geology. All of those are wonderful things. But everybody here wants to study the Dharma and wants to practice their ethics and wants to perfect the six perfections, and that's what they want to do 24/7. And I imagine you've all been in a group where you had something you were interested in, and then you join the group and you see how exponential you can move. Like, you know, I want to climb Mount Hood, but when I got with the Mazamas, I could do it, you know. That's what this is like. Anyway, I'm diverging because I diverge. But I'll come back to the schedule. So then we do service from like 8:30-ish until, you know, we have a break around 10:30 for 15 minutes for tea, and then we do service right up till 12. We have a luncheon break from 12 to 2, and then 2 to 4:30, you're back at service. Could be doing something very different, like in the morning, I might be putting the flower beds to rest for winter, and then in the afternoon, I might be painting a wall, or I might be, you know, cataloging books for the library, or I might be running the Xerox for some retreat, or, you know, you just whatever's set out there for the day. Filling in, somebody's sick, you need to cook medicine meal. And then from 4:30 to 6, we study. Some people study, some keep working. That's a, you know, trying to get more balance is a community issue. You know, we have workaholism even at the Abbey. And we have laziness at the Abbey. We have both, you know. So, and we have them both inside our own selves sometimes. So we kind of move through that. Of course, we spent a lot of time this last year working on Gautami Hall, the women's residence. And we did a lot of the work, a lot of cleanup, a lot of painting, a lot of scraping, a lot of sanding, a lot of varnishing in order to save money. And we came in under budget quite a bit on that, which we're very delighted with, and I think delighted our grantors, our donors. So then at 6 o'clock, we're at medicine meal, which is a light meal, you know, soup, maybe a piece of bread. For a number of the monastics, it's just something to drink unless they've been working hard. And then we meditate again 7 to 8:30. So you get 3 hours of meditation a day built in. You don't have to struggle with yourself. You can all come and see us, and even stay. And that's a delight. You get an hour and a half of Dharma study, and you don't have to struggle to get that. It's built in. And you're around monastics all day long. And then here's the big bonus. You live where your teacher lives, and your teacher is teaching 100% of the time. She's teaching when she's moving. She's teaching, you know how Geshe-la does. You just watch him move and you're learning something. She's teaching when she scolds someone. She's teaching when she's happy with someone. And in fact, she teaches 5 to 10 minutes a day, what's called the Bodhisattva Breakfast Club, which you can go online and pick up all the 5 to 10 minute teaching. she does them, she used to do them in the morning, so we called it Breakfast Club. Now it's at lunchtime, but I think the people who get the Breakfast Club think it's the morning because it's posted the next morning. So it's still called the Bodhisattva Breakfast Club. So she actually does that. And then she often teaches during the week. She teaches every Thursday night. That's online too. Thursdays at 6, but it will go to 7, I think, now that the time changed. I don't know, but it's all on the website. So you're just there. And if you have a Dharma question, your teacher's right there. One chance, and you say, I have a Dharma question. And, you know, we might be there 5 minutes or next half hour or an hour. So that's a tremendous delight. And what can I say? I mean, your practice accelerates. It can't not do that. And that's what we do 7 days a week. We now have built-in flex days. I'm looking at Susan because we didn't have any. And I think, Venerable, flex days aren't in her vocabulary. As she says, Samsara never takes a flex day. And my lamas never took a flex day. But what we say is, we haven't practiced for 25 years, Venerable. We get tired and grumpy, and we need, you know, some time where we just go off and don't have to do the schedule. So we have flex days every other week on Wednesdays. So, and that's less than other monasteries do, but that's what we're doing for now, and we're experimenting with it. And it's quite seeming to be quite helpful. On that day, you can take a longer walk. You're just not on such a tight schedule. The meals are still those 3 times, and we still do our 3 hours of meditation. It's an hour and a half in the morning, hour and a half at night. The rest of the time, that time, that service, you can take a longer woods walk, have a nap, read more if you want, you know, do your emails to your friends, whatever you kind of need to do. So that's kind of it. It's wonderful. I miss Portland terribly. And I know I'm doing the exact right thing. Exactly. So for now, I mean, I just feel fortunate beyond belief to have this opportunity, which is so extremely rare. I mean, the opportunity to even have to be here tonight, to have a Mayatripa center, to have an STB center, to have a connection to a authentic Dharma teachers. Look around the world. How many people have this? Way, way less than probably, I don't know, 2%, 5%, I don't know, but it's small. So we really have to use these opportunities because it's so precious. Our human lives with this kind of opportunity is beyond belief. It really is what they say about it. It's finding the jewel in the heap of garbage. And we have to be sure we, A, recognize it. We don't just throw it away going, oh, what's this piece of rubbish, you know? That we actually, you know, cherish it. That is, cherish our teachers, cherish each other, cherish our practice. So that's all I have to say right now.
Yeah. I have a question. Mm-hmm. Could you speak a little bit about what would be the differences between being a lay person in the monastic setting and being a person who's taken robes in the monastic setting? So at Shravasti, there are, you know, both types of people living there. And so can you speak to the relative benefits or differences between those choices?
Yeah. You know, if you came and just watched physically, you'd say not much difference. You know, you just watch. I mean, we all do the schedule. We all, you know. But it's in the training. The difference is in the training. Like, A, there are certain trainings set up just for the monastics, and Venerable leads those. And so she meets with them about your robes, about your ethics, about the Vinaya, which is the whole, I should memorize the number of vows that the nuns take, 200 and some, and the monks take 100 and some. So studying that whole Vinaya, like what is the meaning of all these rules? You know, not just to have, rules aren't just for rules, but what's the meaning? So they do that, whereas I don't. The training is, how should I say? She gets in there with them, and in a way that she might not do as much with the lay people. So, like, if she would think, let's say Tarfa and I are sitting there, and she would be observing and thinking both of our self-centered attitudes are running, it's kind of like if you take the robes, you've given permission to, please pull me around. And I can see the lay people get a little more leeway. And that might be one of the reasons I want to stay that way. You know, I mean, I'm just being very honest. Like, I often ask myself, why am I not in robes, you know? I don't have the karma for it right now. How do I know that? Because I tortured myself with the question for a long time. And then I said, this is not Dharma, to sit in meditation and go, I should do this. Oh my gosh, I'm scared of it, but I should do it. Oh no. At some point I went, a Venerable was giving a talk and she said, if you come out of your meditation sessions and you are unhappy and you are, you know, you're grumpy, unhappy, I mean, that can happen once in a while, but if it's consistent, you're coming to the wrong conclusion in your meditation session. That's not what it's about. It's the end of suffering, not suffer on the cushion, get off and suffer some more. So I realized this is just suffering, and I have to just put this question behind me. So I went to her and talked with her. I had gone to her and said I wanted to be a monastic. I scared myself to death and then freaked out for a while, and then had to come back and say, I don't know what I'm doing. Which does happen quite a bit, actually, with Westerners. We've had people come for 2 months saying, I'm definitely doing this, and then run down the road, we call it. And someone else comes, I don't know if I'm doing it, and they're ordaining in 6 months, you know. I mean, this unfolds how it unfolds, because everyone has their own karma. But for me, it was so good to just say, I don't know the answer to that. I have to put the question aside. What I do know is I want to be here and I want to help this happen. I am crystal clear about that. I'm crystal clear about the importance of monastics. The Buddha did say we have to have lay men, lay women, monks, and nuns. That's how the Dharma roots and grows. And you can see why you need all four of those. And without those, it won't be the full package. The monastics, because they have the time to sink the roots in and to study and to practice and to go further, then that's what they give us, you know. And then that's why we go to them. I was thinking today, would I be very far without monastics? Geshe was a monastic. That's why he brings that depth in. And I'm not saying, I have been with very deep lay teachers, and I totally appreciate them. And Buddhism says lay people can get fully enlightened. So you don't have to be a monastic to get fully enlightened. There are many, many stories about fully enlightened lay people. It's not saying that. But in the current conditions, you can see family life, modern life, work life, simply makes it so you can't sit 3 hours a day. And you can't, you know, study an hour and a half. And you can't ask your teacher on the spot, you know, what is this definition of emptiness? Why is that one different than this? So if you're in a monastic setting, you get that chance. So basically that difference had is in the training. It's much more direct. And it's much more, you have asked me to help you cut you away from your self-centered hallucination, and I'm going to do it, you know? And I've had the flaming sword pulled out on me once or twice, and it's quite wonderful and jarring, and it takes months to kind of think back, you know. I mean, not think back to it, but to learn from it fully, you know. But they have it more regularly. It's kind of like, I signed up for the Marines, you know. I don't like the analogy, but, you know, like the Green Berets versus the regular Army. No, it's got to be a better analogy than military. But you see what I mean? It's like you're going to get that kind of training. Drop down and do 150 push-ups right now. And I don't care if you cry. I don't mean she's like that, but you know what I'm saying.
Yeah,
on a spiritual level.
On a spiritual level.
Does that answer it?
Yeah.
So the flaming sword is that correction idea?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
It's like Manjushri's. It's the
yes.
flaming sword of truth.
Cutting away the self-centeredness from our conventional self. Because as I understand it from being around Venerable and other teachers, and it feels like it's getting more clear to me, this wonderful conventional self, which is carrying us forward on our path, is under the sway of this really crazy, really not sane self-centeredness, which causes all of our suffering, you know? And you just get to see it more and more and more. I mean, I know you see it the more you practice, right? I mean, you live in a community where everybody's working on it. You see it a lot. You just see it more and more and more. And it's a little, it can be a little horrifying at times, like, oh my God, look what's in my mind. It's beyond selfish. It's mean. It's nasty. It's cruel. Just pop-up thoughts, you know. But you're not so busy and distracted. You see them. You just see them. It's like when you go on a retreat. You see things that you don't see when you're running around all day, you know, doing your good works, which are good, and taking care of family, which is good and necessary. But when you get on retreat, you all know that. How many have been on retreats? Like even a day, you slow down a little bit, longer retreats, you know. You see it, don't you? You start seeing how your mind's operating. Well, this is like a very long retreat. And then we go into more retreat. I mean, the service during the 3 months, we cut our service way down. We're in the hall at least 6 hours a day. And you do that day after day after day, and your mind really settles, and you start really seeing your stuff, you know, and making some real good progress. I hope.
Yes, I am.
What I wanted to ask you about was the retreats. What retreats do you have that are available to other people? What's that schedule like?
Yeah. Well, the best thing is to go on the website, because they're planned like a year ahead pretty much. But the next ones, we have a Thanksgiving retreat, which is like a long weekend. And people will come and we'll take precepts on that day. So we'll just do one meal that day. We'll actually just do juice in the morning, juice at night. And then just actually, that's what we'll do for Thanksgiving. So people will come for just the Thursday. Some of the people will come for the whole weekend and they'll be teaching. Right, and then the very next retreat is going to be the 3 month retreat. And we have, it's Green Tara this time. And we have people signed up for the 1 month. You can come for 1 month or 3 months. Then we'll be out of that retreat in March, and we'll start what are called our summer retreats, which are usually 4 day or 1 week retreats. And they're all kinds of different teachings and different teachers lined up. We had Geshe Pelge here, and he taught on the three principal aspects, not here, there, and taught on the three principal aspects of the path. We had Jeffrey Hopkins. These were both 4 day retreats. On compassion, his new book on compassion. Venerable Children taught on the Heart Sutra, emptiness, for a week. That was fantastic. And we had the Exploring Monastic Life, which is a 3 week retreat for people who are not married and exploring monastic life to come and live at the monastery. And there's discussions every day and teachings every day about the Vinaya and what it takes to make that transition. Doesn't have to be people who are ready to jump into it. It can be people who are just curious and might want to look. That's every year. The young adults, a week happens every summer, a week with people 29 and then, you know, 18 to 29. Although we had a 16-year-old this year with the permission of his parents, which was really fun. And so there's many, many opportunities. And then we do every other month what's called Share the Dharma Day, which is a whole Sunday. And a lot of local people come, people who are just curious about Buddhism. We've had Christians come by. We're 1 hour from Spokane, which is a very Catholic kind of town because of the Gonzaga University and the big Sacred Heart Medical Center. So we have a lot of, we've had visits from Catholic nuns. We had a Catholic nun just take the Heart Sutra week-long retreat. We have these two Carmelite nuns who we're really close to, and they come visit. We go visit them. So the Gonzaga, we have a Buddhist gathering on the Gonzaga campus. That's where they gather for the Thursday night telecast teaching. So there's lots of interreligious activity going on. So there's just a lot that you can come for. And people can come for no retreat. People can just come. It's almost, in some ways, the nicest time to come to the Abbey is to come when there's not a retreat. And you just come. And you just join right in the life. And the only requirement is if you stay there, you do need to stay on the schedule. It's not a Dharma center where you can kind of negotiate the schedule. But I've had friends come who couldn't get up at 5 because of health things, or just it would be way too hard for them. So they stayed down in the little town in Port and just would drive up and, you know, maybe be up there by 10 in the morning, do 2 hours of service, have lunch, do a couple hours of service and go back, and then come back the next day. 2 of my friends came and they did 3 days of that, and it was delightful. We had a wonderful time. And people's families have come and done that, more of that pattern, because, you know, with kids and stuff, you know, you can't really keep that schedule. Yeah. So we're happy to have people come for a day or an hour or however long. It's just 1 hour drive, about an hour and a half drive above Spokane, which is a 1 hour flight from Portland. Yeah. So are there questions? When are you coming? You've been there. Kat's been there. Mm-hmm. And you haven't been there, Rochelle.
Yes.
It's no surprise.
Oh,
it's and, no, and Susan's been there. Yeah, Donnie, you have a question.
Just logistics. If you wanted to drive there, is it a long drive?
It's about 8 hours with enough time to, like, stop for a lunch. I mean, people do buzz through a set. We're at 2,500 feet. And the last 2 winters, we had 10 feet of snow accumulated both winters. So what did we do for our winter exercise? We shoveled snow. And we fall. And then beautiful winter, but really cold, lots of snow.
Wild turkeys.
We have 60 wild turkeys that come and stay with us every winter. I think they are now probably in their 3rd generation, so they're telling their young ones, A, this is a safe place, you won't get hunted, and B, they feed you cracked corn all winter. So if you can't find anything to eat, they'll feed you. So I'm a little worried it could be up to 100. But the really sweet thing is Venerable Senkei. She's such an animal lover. She'll walk outside and they see her in her red robes, and here they go. They are completely imprinted on her. And she got sick last winter, and Venerable Jigme had to fill in. And Venerable Jigme came back the first day saying, "It's scary. I mean, they love you too much." having 60 turkeys come after you. And of course, they don't attack her at all, but it's like, oh my God, this is a lot. You know? So if we get up to 100, I don't know what we'll do. We'll feed them.
What do you do about food in the winter?
I'm so glad you asked the food question, because that's one of the most important things I wanted to talk about. I forgot to talk about the 4 requisites. But the food, A, we only eat what's donated. So get this. I never thought this was possible with generosity. So that's one of the main things I'm learning about. It's the first perfection, generosity, ethics, patience, joyous effort, concentration, wisdom. The first perfection is generosity. Venerable understands generosity in probably the deepest way I've ever seen anybody. When she moved there, she said, and she was there alone the first winter, she said, "I am only going to eat what people give me, because if people, as the Buddha said, if people believe in what I'm doing, they'll feed me. If what I'm doing isn't of help to people, they shouldn't feed me." You know? So we were scared to death. It's like she's gone way over there. She's only going to eat what people give her. She's going to starve. So, honest to God, that's what Seattle and Portland students were like. What should we do? What should we do? So we're calling and trying to figure things out. And she's like, "The cupboards are full. The cupboards are full. Did you go out shopping?" "No, the cupboards are full. People brought food." The cupboards have never been even near empty. In fact, we give food to the food bank because we get so much food. Now, people are feeding 10 people 2 meals a day. And we are never hungry. and it's good food, it's often organic. That just mind boggles me, how much people want this to happen. And then I think something happens to you when you're eating that food, because every meal, of course, we do the prayers that we use this food for the Dharma, not for my own selfish whatevers. But you really get mindful of that, that people want you to be here, but they want you to be here studying the Dharma, not wasting any time being in a negative mind state, not wasting any time being lazy. You know, they really want you to do this. And you really get a sense of, to honor it, you need to be serious about your practice. So that's where you can see the symbiotic relationship between lay and monastic. You know, that the monastics feel that responsibility back to the lay people who are feeding them, if it's working well. Now, even His Holiness the Dalai Lama will say that's a bit of what went wrong in Tibet, that the current karma, you know, that's being experienced, the monastics got too far away, some got too far away from that reciprocal, you know, you don't just take these and have a, you know, an interesting life. You really have to be giving back and teaching and practicing very seriously, because there's, I think there's a saying something like this. I'm not going to get this totally accurately, but it goes, there's a place in the Vajra Hells for those who take from the lay people and do not use it for pure Dharma. It's like one of the really unethical things to do, to take it and use it for your own selfish whatever. So it really puts you in that circle, you know. Now in the winter, what happens? There's a couple things. One is people actually bring food every week. They call up and they say, we want to make an offering, please give us your list. And so we give them what we're missing. And they go shop and they drive it up. They can either donate the shopping time, the driving time, the actual money for the food. And if they can't do the money for the food, they call on the food fund. And there is a food fund to give to that's people all over the world give to. So the shoppers sometimes say, I want to make the donation in the shopping. Sometimes I can only give the shopping time. But during the winter, they still do that same thing. But in order to keep our solitude, we just have a place where they drop the food off. During the rest of the seasons, we meet them and talk and have tea and do a ceremony to accept the food and all that. But in the winter, they just bring it to the very cold workshop and leave it. And, you know, of course, we do our prayers for them. Huh?
No, it won't spoil.
Oh, yes. We're more worried it's freezing. We go down to get it so the lettuce doesn't freeze.
Yeah, the eggs.
Yeah.
Is it all vegetarian, or do you eat meat?
We do not eat any meat, yeah. And we do eat eggs and cheese and milk, yeah. And we work very hard on some of that. Like, you know, we've had many talks and a bit of debate about free-range eggs, you know, organic milk, you know, and those kind of things. And so far what we've decided is it's more of an education process than requiring those very expensive, you know, asking people to buy things that cost twice or three times what they're paying for their own family, you know, people who aren't doing organic and stuff. But it's an education, and more often than not, we get range free eggs, you know, they just buy them because they're also getting more aware. We're all getting more aware of what's happening with animals, you know. So,
do you have people now donating to Newport?
Mostly it's Spokane and Coeur d'Alene. Newport, we've had more people visiting than before, but not many who've actually sort of signed up like I'm a Buddhist, you know. They more come and they'll share the Dharma days and kind of, you know, come for those talks and feel uplifted and then kind of go away and we won't see them for three or four times and then they show up again. So Newport's the closest little town. And it's a much more kind of working class timber town, falling on bad times. Yeah, yeah.
Okay, I have this kind of basic but esoteric question.
Yeah.
So, can you speak to the issue of in what way does a monastic community life. In what way does that community contribute to world peace? Exactly what are they do? Is it internal peace? Peace within the community of the miracle of 10 people living together in the same place, which is sometimes just that much is really impossible. And so that's an accomplishment. Is it an individual qualities of peace within oneself? And or is there some sort of contribution that's made in the wider plane?
Yeah, that's such a good question. It's all three. Yeah. It's all three. And they're concentric circles, you know. We all know we can't do something peaceful if we aren't peaceful. You know, I used to do a lot of social service work in Portland. And I look back now and it was excellent work. I mean, I worked for legal aid kind of offices for poor people doing legal stuff, all kinds of political work. But my mind wasn't peaceful. So what that meant was the work was good but limited, you know, like to the place where I would be angry at some other group, or I would be, these groups are okay, but that one's not, you know. So that meant this was good work, and then there was a limit to it, you know. So that internal work, that's what, why we all meditate, why we come to Dharma, right? Because we know we need that. As we get more peaceful, then whatever community we're in, it could be just a couple, it could be a person with their cat, it could be 10 people living together, that becomes more harmonious, and then a model for, you know, other groups to model on. But in the Abbey, as you saw with the video, we go out to the prison, we teach at the prison, we help the prisoners. There's a lot of us that correspond with the prisoners, and all the correspondence is about your Dharma practice. So creating peace in the prisons, helping those guys who are going to come out, first of all, more peace inside the prison, then they're going to come out and be with their families. Peace amongst the people who come for retreats. I mean, you know how that is. You go to retreat, you feel better when you come out. Your family is happy when you come home, quiet and peaceful and with some more insight. And so we have about, I think the last stats, and I know it's up higher this year, I would guess probably 200 more. Last year we had 500 people who came to the Abbey for various teachings, retreats, a visit, a donation, so make contact. 500, probably this year I would make a guess, I haven't seen the stats, but probably more like 700, because all the retreats are bigger, and the shared Dharma days were big, and then Venerable goes out, and she teaches down in Newport, just a relaxed meditation class, which actually she did at first, and it's fascinating who shows up, and now Venerable Tarpa and Venerable Jigme are teaching that at the local hospital, and the local hospital sees it as a health class thing. So they're giving the room for free and sponsoring it. So that way, I'm trying to think of other ways, but yeah, all of that. Going out and doing Dharma talks. Oh, and there's now a once a week meditation class, how to meditate in Spokane, that Venerable Semke and Venerable Chuni go out to, and that has 30 people in it now, just coming to learn how to sit and be quiet and let go of stress. And now it's starting to move in, what is Buddhism, you know, we're like, what is that, you know. So does that answer it? It's really all those ways. It would seem, you know, you think in a monastery you're going to be isolated. I wish. That's my selfish wish. But there are times when I'm up there going, I thought I came to a quiet monastery. I'm in a room with 3 people snoring. I'm going to get up at 4:30. 27 people are going to be at breakfast. You know what I mean? And even though we're going to be in silence, it's a lot. So, but then we do get our quiet time. So we're definitely not out of the world, you know. Very much in that.
Is it only Buddhists who come to bring you things like food, or do those contacts?
It's kind of mind-boggling. Like, I'll give one example right away, and then I might think of another one. But two women showed up at the door with boxes of food. I went to the door, I got the food, and we were talking, you know, because whoever comes, you want to, you know, have, there's a beautiful little ceremony if there's any monastics there where the people giving read a prayer saying, you know, I want to give this because I want to support your practice and let's create peace in the chaotic world. And then the monastics read a prayer back that basically is a promise, I will use this food exactly as you intended and, you know, keep my vows in this way and let's join together. So it's quite wonderful. It's just a very heartwarming. So we asked people if they want to do that. And then I started chatting with these women because I'd never seen them at anything. And they said, oh, we were up here when one of your people got lost in the woods, which didn't happen, and search and rescue had to come. And it was night and cold. The person did the thing we say don't do. Don't go off the main timber road because it's confusing. It's been logged a lot, and there are many timber roads. You know, we walk in many of those. And you just can't go off one without somebody with you. So easy to get disoriented. This woman was out there for a while and getting hypothermic, and dark was coming, so we called in the search people, which cost a lot, and she helped share the cost of all that. But this was the wife of one of the people who had been on search and rescue, and she had hung out there at the house, and she just liked the whole idea so much that people were doing something good. She wanted to bring food, and she had no intention of, she didn't want to come and meditate or anything. She was like, I want to do this. We had another woman, there was an article in the paper about us, in the local paper. Oh, two things happened out of that. The young reporter who came to do the story comes all the time now to share Dharma days. She hasn't become a Buddhist, but she comes up. She wrote the story, got so fascinated that she comes a lot, and comes and does service, which is nice. But then someone else read the story, jumped in their car, went to the store, bought like 5 boxes of food, and drove to the abbey. She said, you only live on what people give you. I was terrified you guys would starve. I didn't want you to starve. She literally jumped in the car. It was just beyond sweet. And so she stayed and meditated one night. We never saw her again, you know. But
her heart was at rest that you were eating.
Yeah, and she gave that wonderful, wonderful donation. So these things happen, you know. And it's almost 8:30. So I think if we could just do a little teeny closing. Mm-hmm. Okay? Alright, so let's just sit for a minute quietly with each other and just enjoy that we did this and offer the goodness of it up for the end of the suffering of every single being. And may every being that we ever come in contact with have increased happiness, both in the worldly way, like enough food, clothing, shelter, medicine, family, whatever kind of support they need, and also in the Dharma way that they find their way to a good spiritual path, the one that's right for them, and that they practice well, and that they increase wisdom and compassion in the world. As we will do together. Okay. That's the stuff.
It's wonderful. Thank you all.
Thank you for coming and hearing more. And really, really, do go on the website. Please take a postcard or two of Gautami. That's the stained glass window by a woman artist. And Gautami, the hall's name for the first Buddhist nun. It was Shakyamuni's auntie who raised him after his mom died. And she had to be mad to be given vows because it was India 2,600 years ago, women did. So the Buddha said no twice. And then Ananda said to him, you got to do it. This is your aunt. I mean, that's the legend.
Yeah.
She's your aunt. She's been following you. She has 500 nuns. And the question he asked is, do you think that women can reach enlightenment? And the Buddha said, sure. And Ananda said, so, you got to do this. It doesn't matter.
And besides, it's
out.
PC.
Yeah!